Our guest here in hour number one of Focus is Catherine Newman. She's an associate professor of anthropology and fellow of the Center for American Culture Studies at Columbia University, and is the author of the book Falling from Grace, The Experience of Downward Mobility in the American Middle Class. It's recently been published by the Free Press, which is a division of Macmillan. And in the course of preparing for the book, Professor Newman interviewed 150 people and looked at people in four major groups. They are former business executives, air traffic controllers who were fired a couple of years ago when they went on strike, blue-collar workers who were laid off, and women who were divorced. And they are all people whose standard of living suffered an abrupt and, in some cases, steep decline. And she tells their stories in this book, and it's quite an interesting one. As we talk, again, you're invited to join us and participate in the program. Professor Newman, hello.
Good morning.
I'm pleased that you could spend some time with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Perhaps to begin, a couple of questions that you deal with in the beginning of the book yourself, and that is, why study downward mobility, and how, as an anthropologist, your approach may differ from, say, an economist or an historian that would be looking at the same kind of material?
Mm-hmm. Well, as an anthropologist, my interest is in the study of our own society, in the study of American culture. And my feeling was that in recent years we'd begun to develop a particular picture of the middle class experience in our country that was not altogether accurate. These phrases, mourning in America, great prosperity, everyone's on the move, seem to me to be missing an important aspect of the American experience, which is the reversal of our expectations for long-term prosperity. And as an anthropologist, my particular interest was in what this kind of reversal means to the people to whom it happens. So the ways in which I differ from, say, an economist would be that I'm not simply interested in the large-scale patterns of downward mobility, although that is important, of course, but I'm interested more in how the experience reflects on central aspects and themes of American culture, how it reflects on our ideas about meritocracy, our vision of the good life, our view of what people are entitled to expect. And those are the kinds of issues which I think are ideally suited to an anthropological perspective, and that's what I decided to pursue in the book.
Mm-hmm. Now, these are people that, to be clear, are not, even after their fall, most of them would technically not fall below the poverty level.
That's right. They would not fall below the poverty level, mm-hmm. but they would now have fallen largely out of the middle class and mm-hmm. might be classified more along the lines of the working poor or perhaps, at the best, the lower middle class. But they are people who've taken a dramatic cut in their standard of living and whose occupational identity has been severely disrupted.
How many people are we talking about, and how far in economic terms was the fall?
Well, it's difficult to say exactly how many people we're talking about. One of the interesting cultural questions we might ask of the Bureau of Labor Statistics is why we don't track phenomena like this more carefully. But the few studies we have that do allow us to assess how many people are involved come from studies of displaced workers. Between about 1981 and 1986 or thereabouts, about 11 million people in the United States, 11 million workers, were officially classified by the BLS as displaced workers. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics tried to track to some extent what happened to these people. And what we find over the long haul is that about half of them became downwardly mobile. That is, they suffered severe cuts in their income or were only able to find part-time jobs or remained out of the labor force altogether. Now, this does not take into account a very large category of downwardly mobile families, which are the families of divorce, principally families headed by women who once were occupants of the middle class and whose families can no longer remain in that comfortable category once they are solely responsible for the support of their children. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about, I would say, conservatively 10 million Americans between 1981 and 1986.
You make the observation, and I think it's an interesting one, that these people have not been studied very much. We don't have a great deal of information about them.
Right.
And you you make the assertion or the suggestion that it may be because their experience contradicts what is a very powerful belief in this society, that is that over time people are going to manage to make their way up the ladder, and that these are folks that have slipped, and it may be just a little bit uncomfortable to be reminded of the fact that the progress up the ladder is not guaranteed and it's not inevitable.
That's right. I think many of these people feel themselves to be pariahs or carriers of a contagious disease, or at least they feel they're treated that way by others, including people who used to be close friends of theirs. And I think as a society, we are unwilling, or our culture makes it very difficult for us to understand or take a close look at people who've suffered this kind of reversal. From our earliest beginnings in the Puritan period, we have emphasized upward mobility, progress, forward motion. And except in periods of tremendous calamity, like the Great Depression, we seem very, very unable to confront the reversals, confront the downside, even though it's there. When I went to look to see if there was any other literature in the social sciences or among the historians on the subject of downward mobility, I really had to go back to the period of the 1930s to find anything at all relevant to my own interests. And I think that says something about our expectations and about our culture, that we find it very difficult to face the reality of these kinds of losses and devastation.
Yeah, I wanted to get into talking specifically about each of the four groups of people that you looked at. But before doing that, just to make the general observation that'll be borne out by the specific examples, that how people feel about their experience depends a great deal on the circumstances involved in their fall, and it has a lot to do with the extent to which they feel they were personally responsible, and it seems also to have a lot to do with whether they see themselves as out there all alone, or that they are in a group that their fate is shared with some other people, and there is some group solidarity provided by that.
That's right. That's a very central dimension that differentiates the downwardly mobile. One of the things I was anxious to do in the book was to try and show that this experience has many different shades and meanings, because our culture provides different templates that people can and do invoke in understanding their own personal experience. So downward mobility doesn't mean the same thing for every single individual. It means quite different things to different groups of people. So my interest, once again, as an anthropologist, was in understanding what those differences were and why they developed. Why is it that some people feel that they're alone and isolated and that they are the only person to whom this has ever happened, while others see themselves as part of a victimized brotherhood that must stand together to struggle to avoid defeat? These are all competing aspects of American culture, different themes that coexist in our society. And they were the themes and ideas which these downwardly mobile people grasped onto in the midst of their own personal trouble.
Well, I want to get to some specifics here, but I have a caller who is holding on here, and I tell you what, I think I'd like to bring them into the conversation, and then we'll talk in more detail about some of the groups that you looked at in the book. We're talking with anthropologist Catherine Newman from Columbia University about her book, Falling from Grace, The Experience of Downward Mobility in the American Middle Class. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455, toll-free in Illinois, 800-222-9455. Here's someone on our line number one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I'm sure the good professor will be able to shoot me down before she knows what I'm talking about. But I'm just wondering if the educators are not a substantial part of the problem.
How's that?
I got 33 years trying to use the products of our schools to operate and maintain the nation's weapon systems.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've noticed something very obvious and very progressively downward, and that is that, at the end of World War II, we had manual training, and the purpose of this was to teach the kids to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't have, most of the teachers were not college graduates.
Mm-hmm.
And so then as we progressed, like pretty soon, the teachers had to be college graduates. So they changed manual training to industrial arts.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we got further away from this old argument about whether we should educate our people or train our people. And we drift towards the pure education for all our people, whether they can or can't, will or won't, or want it or not.
Well, you know, I think that I think we all recognize that our economy has undergone some very profound changes since the Second World War. We have, for better or worse, moved away from a heavy manufacturing-based economy toward a services economy. And, you know, we can debate whether or not that was a good thing. It certainly is a fact of our economic lives. And that shift demanded certain things of the educational enterprise. It demands the production of better educated people who can function within the service industries. Now, you know, that Second World War period, the 1950s, was a period of enormous prosperity. So the upswing in our educational industry also produced huge generations of engineers, of doctors, lawyers, teachers, bankers, and so on, all of whom were beneficiaries of our post-World War II prosperity. So I don't think that the shift toward what we might call a more pure education as opposed to applied education is really responsible for this. But I think that it is responsible for, or at least contributed to, the rising expectations that most adults had in the post-World War II period, and which they have transmitted to their baby boom children for continued prosperity and home ownership and all of the other trappings of a middle-class life. So what we have seen is a development of a series of expectations which, for many people, are not being met. And, of course, education contributes to that because once in possession of a college degree, people expect they're going to be able to find jobs and hold on to jobs that befit a college graduate. And what many of them are finding is that this service economy doesn't provide those kinds of jobs in large numbers, or that even if they have them, they won't be able to hold on to them. So there's certainly a relationship between education and expectations, but then again, I think those expectations are part of what we've come to call the American dream, and we have to face the question of whether or not that dream is to be maintained or whether we're going to let it go by the boards.
And I think what as we talk about in more detail about some of the people that you look at in the book, I think that people will see that in spite of the fact that some of these people blame themselves for their own fall or their own slip down the economic ladder, that in many cases it's not their fault.
Mm-hmm.
That is, it wasn't because they weren't smart enough, that they weren't good at their jobs, and certainly in the cases of divorced women, that it was just something that happened to them, even though in that case they might take it as an indication of personal failure.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult to say that these people were instrumental in their own downfall.
Most of the people that I interviewed for the book were not instrumental in their own downfall. Many of them had worked for 20 or 30 years for the same business. These were not people who were inexperienced, uncredentialed, unable to hold down a job. These were people with a wealth of experience who never expected anything like this could ever happen to them. So it's certainly not the case in most instances that they were instrumental in their own demise. But once again, as an anthropologist, what interested me is why, nonetheless, many of them came to the conclusion that it was their fault or that it is their fault that they're unable to find new positions that accord with their experience. What is it about our culture that drives home this sense of personal failing that many of these people felt?
Mm-hmm. Well, we will get to that point in a minute. I have another caller. Let's talk with them here on our line number two. Hello.
Well, actually, my point is quite pertinent because I was going to pass on an observation about that very issue.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to pass on a thesis put forward by one of my social work professors a number of years ago,
mm-hmm.
and she addressed the issue of why people are poor and what other people think about that.
Mm-hmm.
And what she suggested was that when many people find themselves in a situation of poverty, as we did during the Depression, for instance, then people as a group are more likely to look around them and say, there must be something in the system that has made me be this way. Whereas when we have a time of arguably economic prosperity, as we have, for instance, in the last 8 years, then there's attitudes among the people that if you're not doing well, it must be your own individual fault. And certainly, for instance, some of Reagan's ideas about the truly needy, as opposed to people that might be oppressed by the system, kind of reflect that attitude that if you're not doing well, it's your own fault.
I think that's a very good point, and it's one of the points that I raise in the book. Certainly, the economic context makes an enormous difference, although it's interesting if you look at the research on the Great Depression. Even there, you will find an enormous amount of self-blame, way beyond what one would have expected, given the massive amount of dislocation. And, in fact, the programs that were brought in during the Depression, the Social Security system, the unemployment system, and so on, met with tremendous opposition. And one of the reasons why largely the business community opposed these programs was they argued this would create a soft America, that this would... These were socialistic policies that would make people feel they weren't completely responsible for themselves. So I think even our perspective of the Great Depression is to some extent misleading. There were people who felt they were to blame. It seems absurd to us now to think that anyone could view it that way with unemployment figures that reached up to 25%, and those were official unemployment figures. Nonetheless, I think that while economic context plays a role, there are also persistent themes in American culture that play a role. We have this sense of control over our own destiny. We have a kind of Calvinist ethic that says you are the master of your own fate. And that is coupled with a view that occupation somehow measures your moral worth. And with those two ideas in combination, we get a just devastating synergy that leads people who have had trouble to come to see themselves as largely responsible.
Would you say that there's a better example of a time when people were more aware that their economic downfall was a result of systemic factors as opposed to personal downfall?
I think that many people understand the role of systemic factors for a while, and some of them are able to hold on to that understanding and make it part of their own personal explanations for their own losses for longer than others. For example, the air traffic controllers who I studied knew and still know that they had an enemy, that enemy led them into into disaster. They understand that there were larger systemic factors that led to their downfall, and they have persisted in that understanding. Whereas the executives and the managers that I studied, even though they might have known in the beginning that, say, their industry was in trouble and that was why they lost their jobs, that systemic or structural understanding dissipated very quickly. It disappeared within a matter of months, and the self-blame took the place of that broader understanding of economic forces at work. So even in the modern period, there are groups of people who can hold on to that notion of broader forces at play or trampling over their own lives better than some. But I suppose the Depression is a good example of the period in which people had a better understanding. It simply wasn't a perfect understanding of the forces at play in their lives.
Mm-hmm. And so you would say that the overarching theme is the one kind of rugged American individualism?
I think that American individualism plays an enormous role, but we have to understand what that individualism means. It is a theme that particularly emphasizes notions of control, of self-control, of being master of your own destiny, and that your fate, occupational fate in this instance, really is an accurate measurement of your internal moral worth. And that is the really devastating aspect of the culture we live in. You know, in other societies, perhaps those which have held on to a notion of blood descent as being more important or royalty as important, you can find people whose economic lives are not particularly glorious, but they trace their lineage to, you know, Louis XIV or something. And that holds on, that provides some sense of meaning in their lives that's independent of their occupations. But in the United States, I would argue that occupation, since the Second World War, has become an absolutely critical aspect of our personal identities, that there isn't anything that's more important than that. And when that becomes the measurement of one's personal worth and the overall crucible of one's identity, the loss of that occupation is truly devastating on all fronts.
I know that as an anthropologist that you're an observer of culture as opposed to a political scientist or a social worker, mm-hmm. but do you have any suggestions on how to help people understand clearer the systemic factors that influence them and perhaps kind of combat some of these mythical ideas about control?
Well, as an anthropologist, I feel my greatest contribution is in writing books like the one that I'm discussing this morning. That is, I wrote Falling from Grace because I hoped that it would contribute to a broader perspective and a public recognition of this problem. I was following belatedly in the footsteps of C. Wright Mills, the famous sociologist, who really saw the social sciences as playing an important role in defining personal troubles as public issues. And that's what I think a responsible social scientist can do to enlighten people, to show them examples of people who met this kind of fate through no fault of their own and whose own culture participated in the destruction of their lives. So I think that that's extremely important. I also, whenever I appear on these kinds of programs, do try to talk about the public policy remedies or prospects for amelioration that the government can offer. And I argue that this is not an issue to be left simply to market forces. This is not an arena in which a laissez-faire attitude is likely to be of much assistance, that we do have to look to what the forces of government can offer to salvage the lives of these people who, after all, represent a tremendous repository of experience, capacity, education, and aspirations.
And yet what we come back to in the end is individual attitudes. Mm-hmm. It's still, to me, it's fascinating the differences and the similarities between the business executives and the air traffic controllers, and the fact that here we have two groups of people who were, in many cases, they were very highly skilled, very highly trained. They were doing jobs that not everyone could do,
mm-hmm.
And that we, in the case of the air traffic controllers, here we can say, here's a group that truly was instrumental in their own downfall. You know, they went on strike. The president said, if you stay on strike, we're going to fire you. They continued on strike. They were fired. And
mm-hmm.
the executives, in many cases, they may have been doing good jobs, but for reasons beyond their control, they lost their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's the executives that blame themselves.
That's
and
right.
The traffic controllers, somehow they, you know, because they can say they were holding on to principle.
Mm-hmm.
They were, you know, they made a sacrifice for what they thought was the public good, and that, you know, even though these people were experiencing really serious economic dislocations,
mm-hmm.
even a number of them committed suicide because
mm-hmm.
of the stress resulting from the strike, they as a group somehow still have managed to say, well, we did it for a good cause, and that somehow we weren't really responsible in a way that the executives can't do. I mean,
That's right.
They take it intensely personally.
I think the key word here is group. The air traffic controllers really were and still are bound together by a group orientation and by group structures. They were part of a union. That union continued to meet throughout the strike and thereafter. Every year on the 5th of August, air traffic controllers all over the United States gather together in their local communities to commemorate the strike. They have a hotline in Washington, D.C. that just rings without ceasing every time there's a crash. There is great meaning to that group orientation. It both was structural. There really were groups they could join and be part of and continue to stay in contact with, and cognitive. It was also part of their way of thinking that they were bound together by this, by the brutality of this experience and the devastation of their losses. The executives were not bound into groups, or if they were, they lost that group structure very, very quickly. So that some of the examples I draw in the book, for example, were, one man who was one of 55 people let go on the same day. Now, you, in theory, you could imagine that person continuing to see himself as one of 55, but in fact, there was nothing to bind him together to the other 54 people. He lost contact with them. They didn't meet. They didn't see each other. They drifted off to their own homes and behind the privacy of their own closed doors attempted to deal with the personal devastation. There was no group structure, and there is no group structure for the vast majority of managers and executives. They live very individualistic lives. The air traffic controllers and the union people I studied in the blue-collar section were fundamentally different in the way in which their lives were held bound together by this group orientation. And I think structurally that groups tend to produce these ideologies or belief systems about the righteousness of their actions. They tend to develop notions about causes and principles and so on. Where individuals entirely on their own have great difficulty doing so. The only kind of individualistic experience that produces anything like that is the whistleblower, the independent whistleblower who ends up being fired, as most whistleblowers do, calls on the same kind of imagery that the air traffic controllers held near and dear, that they were a persecuted group, that they stood for a set of principles, even though those principles were not recognized by the general public, that they will someday be vindicated, and this is what allows them to continue scanning the newspapers every day for further evidence 8-9 years down the line that they were right, and to believe that they will someday be vindicated. And it's with that kind of cultural projection in mind that they hold on to a sense of personal integrity, that other groups who never see themselves as part of a cause lose very quickly.
Well, this morning our guest on Focus 580 is Catherine Newman. She's an associate professor of anthropology at Columbia University and is author of the recently published book Falling from Grace, The Experience of Downward Mobility in the American Middle Class. You're listening to Focus 580. It's our telephone talk program here on AM 580. My name is David Inge. And in this part of our program, we're talking about downward mobility in the American middle class. And our guest is Catherine Newman. She's an anthropologist and author of the book Falling from Grace. It's a book that takes a look at this phenomenon, that is, the fall of middle-class families down the social ladder. And it takes a look in detail at people in four groups, business executives, air traffic controllers, blue-collar workers who were laid off when their plant was closed, and women who were divorced, and takes a look at the ways in which these people reacted to their experience and thought about it. It's quite an interesting book. I have a couple of callers here. We'll get into the conversation. And if you have been listening and you have some thoughts of your own to offer or a question to ask, it's welcome. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free in Illinois, 800-222-9455. Well, we'll go next to our toll-free line and talk with someone right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
You've mentioned Calvin, and you've mentioned righteousness and grace as part of your title of your book, so I feel this comment is justified. As a follower of Harold Rowley and Gerhard von Rad and some of the other great theological thinkers of the 20th century, I would like to comment that perhaps American Christianity is not truly Christian in the light of the fact that he who turns his back upon his brother when he sees him in need does not belong to Jesus Christ. Now, American Calvinistic work ethic kind of way of life seems to take mercy out of the picture and perhaps leave it only to the socialists. So perhaps there's no real Christianity in Christianity in America today.
Well, I wouldn't know quite how to comment on that specifically.
Well, it's just that a kind of Christianity has come into being which leaves mercy and help of your fallen brother who has slid down the social ladder economically. You don't turn to him, you don't help him, you don't do anything for him, you turn your back on him, and this is anti-Christian.
Well, I think it certainly is not a particularly socially progressive aspect of modern culture. I wouldn't say that it's the provenance of any particular religious group. I think that it's part of our culture as a whole, unfortunately. I mean, I certainly think that it's unfortunate, and the attitude that we associate with traditional Christian values of concern for the other, we could certainly use a healthy dose of that. But I think that, unfortunately, all religious denominations that are practicing in the United States today are part of our more general culture, and that more general culture doesn't provide a great deal of cushion, sympathy, or understanding for people who are in trouble. We are very quick to condemn. We are very quick to believe that people should be completely responsible for themselves, and to look askance at those who either need assistance or have fallen down the ladder. That is, we tend to think that there must be something internally defective about them, rather than assuming that they were victimized by forces that are larger than themselves. So help is needed from all corners, religious, social policy people, government people, private sector people, and I think it would be appreciated no matter what its origin.
Do you think it's really true, though? You talk about the fact that some of these people report that, I think it seems especially true of the business executives, and some of these people report that after their fall, people who were former friends and associates avoid them. They treat them, the word I think you used, and the word that comes to my mind is pariah. They feel that they have no support from former associates. And I wonder to what extent that is a reflection of the inner feeling of the individual, whether they're putting some of that, whether they're projecting some of that, or do you think that is really there?
Well, I think that both aspects are operating simultaneously, and I did sort of describe this in the book. That is, people who are undergoing tremendous stress and disappointment do withdraw very often. I mean, they are so ashamed and embarrassed about what has happened and so devastated by the experience that they don't feel that there's a lot they can contribute to their social relationships, even with close friends. They just sometimes want to just hide and lick their wounds, and that can have very devastating consequences for their recovery, because if they cut links to the people who might be able to help them, very often they'll find themselves spinning all alone, and so that can be very, very destructive. By the same token, however, many people who did try to hold on to friends made great efforts to keep their friendship networks intact, found that they were being shunned, that they were not being, no one would call them anymore, that when they called their friends, people seemed to be trying to get off the phone quickly. This was especially difficult for people who were longtime business associates, that is, people who had social relationships but whose primary connection to each other was through the workplace. With the absence of the workplace, those ties crumbled incredibly quickly. Even people who'd worked side by side for 20 years, the ties really snapped under the pressure of downward mobility. And this was a shock to many people who went through it. They really thought these were friends for life, and then found out that they were not exactly fair-weather friends, but at least friends who couldn't withstand the pressures of one party becoming downwardly mobile. So I think it's a two-way street. It is composed both of the withdrawal of the victim and the shunning of the other parties.
Well, let's take some other callers here. We have two people. We'll go first to line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask your guest if by downward mobility she means only in the material sense. Did these people retain a cultural, by cultural I mean, did they still value getting, you know, as much education for their children, exposing them to the arts, exposing them to literature? I asked the question because I personally was raised in a working class family.
Mm-hmm.
But my parents had middle-class values, so we lived in New York, and they took us to museums, they took us to the arts. You know, they exposed us to as much as they could that was free in New York City. Even though we didn't have the dollar middle-class status, I was given a sense of the aesthetics of the middle class. And I wonder if, when you talk about falling from grace, you're talking about a material fall where they have to move from a large six-bedroom house down to an apartment, or have they also dropped their middle-class values in terms of culture and all the other things?
No, I think that's a very interesting question, which I do try to deal with in the book. It is primarily a material fall, but it catalyzes a whole series of transformations in family life, some of which are quite devastating. That is, these people find that they are enormously confused over what values to transmit to their children. After all, the values they themselves embody, those of hard work, of educational achievement, of persistence and striving seem not to be working. They seem to be, to have led nowhere, or even worse, to have led to some degree of achievement only to see it evaporate. Mm-hmm. Hence, they find themselves incredibly confused about what lessons to teach their children.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so clear, you know. It's very, if you think that education is the key to your own prosperity and enrichment, then you will transmit that value to your child. If, on the other hand, it did not protect you against this devastating reversal of your fortunes, then what exactly are you going to teach your child? And in fact, a good deal of my book, one whole section of it, has to do with how children, what messages this experience conveys to the children.
Mm-hmm.
And in some instances, it conveys a message that is extremely negative about these educational and cultural values, which is that it doesn't protect you, it doesn't help you, you're better off not to go for it at all.
Mm-hmm.
I found many children in downwardly mobile families who, for all of their demographic background, would be expected to be college-bound, saying, forget it, I just want to get rich as quickly as possible to try and reverse the stigma and stain that has fallen upon the family.
Yeah. Well, that upsets me as an educator, because I believe more people should be educated for the joy of education and not always look at it as, you know, the road to the pot at the end of the rainbow.
Well, I think that, you know, many people do feel that way and would like to feel that way even more than they do.
Mm-hmm.
However, economic reality intrudes upon those feelings very often. I'm an educator myself, and of course I agree with you about the importance of education.
Mm-hmm.
Nonetheless, when I look at my own students and the children and the families I studied who are facing, you know, what to do with their futures and whether or not they're going to have a future that accords with the values they have, it would be, you know, shutting an eye to the reality of their lives and to the need for them to find a way to pay the rent. And to provide, a roof over the heads for their children, and to provide some modicum of economic security, it would be foolish to assume that that's of no importance to them. It is the foundation upon which these other values and positive experiences can be built. But lacking that, people don't have a lot of time, energy, or stability to go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art if they're worried about whether or not they can make it to the end of the month. And that is precisely what happens to these families. So unfortunately, you know, for us educators, it means that their feelings about cultural institutions and the prospects of continuing to enjoy those institutions are sort of put on hold while they attempt to figure out whether or not they can just survive. So I think that, I mean, I agree with you, and I myself had a similar kind of upbringing. But what I see in these families is a sudden surge of instrumentality, which the children feel very keenly, and their parents suddenly find, they need to emphasize as well.
Hmm. Let's go on to another caller here. We have someone on our line number two. Hello.
Yes, me, I guess?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I just have a little comment or a question or something, but, I should start with I am a farmer myself.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we had a lot of drought this year. But I would mention that, you know, there was a insurance that farmers could purchase, federal crop insurance.
Right.
But, you know, I think maybe 75% of them, chose not to. Now, that's a choice there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad the government did kind of, you know, step in and, you know, give out money. But, you know, there's a place where, you know, you're kind of, you make the decision.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really push it on anybody else, because even the premium on that federal crop insurance is subsidized with some tax dollars. I think you pay maybe 75% to 80% of the actual value of the premium, and the
mm-hmm.
government pays the other. And we've had droughts in 80 and mm-hmm. a severe one in 83 again.
Mm-hmm.
And still, you know, the people don't sign up for it.
Well, you know, people don't always pursue their own rational interests. I seem to recall some articles about how various insurance companies were attempting to pull the plug on that drought insurance as well, that it was not a bargain that was universally lived up to. But I think taking your larger point about to what extent are people responsible for their own problems, you know, sometimes that's the case. Sometimes there's a calculated judgment that turns out to be incorrect. That, however, in my experience, in my research, turned out to be the minority experience. The minority of cases were those in which one could clearly see a role that the downwardly mobile person had played in their own demise. I'm not saying that never happens, but I think it is interesting that we continue to search for that episode. We continue to search for the person who is personally responsible, and when we find them, somehow it makes us feel like we can ignore everyone else who didn't play any substantial role in their own problems. There is something about our culture that reassures us when we can pin the blame on the individual. And I think that, while that happens sometimes, it is not the majority experience. The majority experience, whether we're talking about executives caught in mergers, which have tripled in the last 10 years, or whether we're talking about blue-collar workers whose factories have shut down and fled overseas or to low-wage areas, those are the majority experiences of the downwardly mobile, and they were not under the control of those individuals.
We have about 10 minutes left. Our guest is Catherine Newman, anthropologist from Columbia University and author of the book Falling from Grace, The Experience of Downward Mobility in the American Middle Class. If there are some other folks who would like to get in with some questions or comments, 333-WILL or 9455. That's here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free in Illinois, 800-222-WILL. There is one fourth group that you talk about in the book that we have not talked about yet, and I want to make sure we say a couple of things about them, and these are the middle-class women who suffered their economic dislocation as a result of divorce. Mm-hmm. How are they like and unlike the other groups that we have talked about?
Well, they are somewhat like the executives in that they tend to be rather isolated and to have to contend with the impact of divorce-led downward mobility alone. And they often feel that other people don't understand them and don't really appreciate how difficult their lives are. You know, the problem for divorced women is both a personal or emotional experience of the loss of a family life and an economic experience, because the major reason why these women are downwardly mobile is that women still, even in 1988, earn only about 70 cents compared to every dollar earned by men. They tend to be trapped in low-wage occupations which don't hold a great deal of promise for a long-term career future. You know, all the emphasis we see in the media about career women, about professionals and so on, that's an extremely small proportion of the working women of America. Most women are working in jobs like waitresses, low-level clerical workers. Those are not jobs that can keep a family in the middle class if that's the single earner in the household. So it is both a job-related problem and, of course, an emotional experience. But one of the things that interested me about divorced women was the importance of the generations from which they come and how different generations assign different aspects of meaning to the experience of downward mobility. So I studied two different groups of divorced women. One group were those who were born between the years of the Great Depression and the onset of World War II, and the others were post-war baby boom women. And what I found in the older group was that these were women for whom the Great Depression was a vivid memory. It occurred when they were young children, but it left a real indelible impression on their lives. Hence, they knew what economic loss was all about, and they did not have any romantic notions associated with hardship. They had a lot of fear in connection with that hardship. This was especially true for women who were on the farms in the Midwest and whose families lost their land during the Depression. Those women then became part of one of the most sustained upward booms in American history, the post-World War II boom, which caught them as they were leading into their married lives. So their lifetime economic trajectories were ones that were grounded in disaster and then a steep ascent into the modern middle class, so that when they met the fate of downward mobility because of divorce, lurking in the background was this fear and recognition of what hardship means. And it was a constant subtext for them. I remember what this was like before. It was terrible. I hated it. I'm scared of it. But they also, at the same time, had certain practical skills. They knew how to cut their budgets. They did know what it meant to live with scarcity. And it wasn't something they were happy to do, but at least they had been there before and knew what that meant. For the younger women, a completely different cultural trajectory. They were post-World War II children of the middle class. They did not have economic devastation in their backgrounds. This was their first taste of disaster. So they didn't have the lurking fears that their older counterparts had. And they also didn't have the coping skills. They came from comfortable families. They didn't really know how to do budget cutting. They really didn't know what it meant to skimp and save. And, of course, the dynamics of their relations with their own children were uppermost in their minds. They felt that they were now having to deny their children the kind of material upbringing they had had themselves. And this was very difficult for them to cope with. So I think what was important about these women for me was the way in which generational membership influenced the meanings that they assigned to downward mobility and the problems that they encountered.
Mm-hmm. When you take a look at these various people, one of the things that you will see is that some of them are in part mourning the loss of the material aspects of middle class life.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems that there's something else going on, that they perhaps more than that they're mourning the loss of something that is much more abstract. And in the book that you suggest, one of the things you can learn from studying these people is that it really offers a glimpse of what it means to be middle class in America. What is that? What is that abstract thing that these people are mourning?
I think that they are mourning more than anything else a sense of rightful place in the society they live in. Now, part of that rightful place has to do with security, which is a material thing, but it's also a conceptual tool with which we live. They are mourning a loss of a centered, grounded sense of place in their society. They're mourning a loss of control, which is also part of what it means to be middle class. They don't feel that they are the masters of their lives anymore. They feel that they're being buffeted around by the fates without their own interventions making much difference. This is an experience which many poor people have to contend with every day, but it is not an experience that's common for middle-class people. They are mourning the loss of a sense of a future. They're mourning the end of their plans, their hopes for the future. They're mourning the ability to transmit advantages to their children, material, educational, conceptual. They are mourning that loss of stability and security that is essential to a middle-class life. And those are the things, when we add in then the loss of occupational identity, which I think is extremely important. You know, we think about jobs as a way of paying the bills. But for these people, the jobs they had were much more important than that. It provided them a secure place in a social structure. It provided them with friendships. It provided them with an identity, a sense of purpose. And it's the loss of that which is enormously devastating to them, because the kinds of jobs that they can find now don't provide that, don't provide them with a sense of purpose. They provide only a meager paycheck and not one that's sufficient to sustain the lifestyle they had before either. So what it taught me about the middle class was that we greatly value concepts of control, security, stability, prosperity, not just in an economic sense, but in the sense of being able to provide our children something more than what we had ourselves. It really interrupts what for many families has been a sustained ascent since the Great Depression, and casts all of the aspirations and plans of their families reaching up the generations and down the generations. It casts all of their collective efforts into doubt and leaves them unable to understand or to know what lessons they should teach their children, what lessons they can draw from their own lives.
Hmm.
At the same time, it taught me something about the value of commitments in American life. So that the greatest devastation fell on the shoulders of people who had no one else to turn to, who didn't see themselves as part of a group. Those people who were parts of groups show us that Americans do greatly value concepts of principle, of sacrifice, and that they can withstand tremendous material disappointment if they have their personal integrity intact. And what allows them to keep it intact is a sense of brotherhood, of participation, of group orientation. So there are pockets of our society in which that's the case and which sustain people and make them feel that there is something much more important than simply their financial well-being. There is also that sense of personal integrity and identity that's important. So it taught me that the middle class is a many-faceted thing, and that we can't simply talk about middle-class values as if they were uniform across all people who we might call middle-class in our country.
Hmm. I have one last caller, and I only have about a minute, and
okay.
I would like to try and squeeze him in. We'll go here to line number one. If you can make your comment brief.
Okay.
Go ahead.
David?
Yes.
Okay. You may have covered this before. Obviously, during the campaign, we've heard the talk about a gentler and kinder America. How does your guest feel about the new administration coming in and their helping the downwardly mobile?
I think about the only positive thing I can say about that in the wake of the election returns is that I think there will be many, many more people for me to study in the category of the downwardly mobile. I think we are about to head into a very severe recession, and the ranks of the downwardly mobile are going to grow, and I think that's highly unfortunate. So I don't think we're going to see great initiatives coming out of the Bush administration to help the downwardly mobile, and I think that's a tragedy.
And do the kind of attitudes that these people have that we have talked about, especially the idea that there is no guarantee that hard work will pay off and be rewarded and the climb up the ladder is not inevitable. Do those kinds of things, are there enough of these people, are the attitudes widespread enough for that to influence the national thinking?
I think it did influence the national thinking in the election campaign. I think those people who voted for Dukakis were precisely the kinds of people who were hurt in the last 8 years and who are worried about whether this, their slide is likely to continue. But will it influence our social policies? Only if the Democratic Congress is able to push forward programs that can be helpful, because I don't think we're going to see leadership out of the White House on these issues. The themes of self-reliance, of it's all up to you, of everyone's doing better, and if you're not, that's your problem, those were very strong themes in the Bush campaign rhetoric. And they spoke directly at the heartland of the downwardly mobile, and they are devastating ideas.
Okay. We are out of time. It's quite an interesting book, and it's been a good time here this morning. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our guest is Catherine Newman. She's professor of anthropology at Columbia University, and her book is entitled Falling from Grace, The Experience of Downward Mobility in the American Middle Class. It's published by Free Press. That's a division of Macmillan.